Gotta be honest, I don't really want to do this teaching because I'm not good at what we're about to talk about, but let's go there. You see, as we're concluding our Beyond Enemies series, I want to explore what happens when the enemy-making machine is at work, but like not out there in some kind of ideological sense, but when our enemies are people we know and see, people in our lives who have hurt or wronged us. How do we deal with conflict then? What happens when the enemy-making machine gets personal? And I think a lot of times it's difficult for people to sort of imagine. I mean, enemy feels like such a strong word, right? So I think for many of us, it can feel like, well, I don't know if I have any enemies per se. So how do we sort of frame this? And enemies can feel too strong. So I want to frame it with a question for us. Who have you distanced yourself from? I think answering that question can help us identify who might be playing the role of enemy in our own lives. When we have distanced ourselves from someone, that can be an indicator that we see them in some capacity as enemy. Who are we trying to avoid or spend less time with? Who in our lives are we creating some intentional distance with? Whoever that is, that's sort of who I'm talking about this morning. And the key with this question to me is understanding that distancing ourselves from others is a very natural human phenomenon. It's natural to want to put distance between ourselves and those people or those things that threaten us or hurt us. Putting distance between ourselves and what we deem as dangerous can be a good thing. I traveled with my brothers a year ago, and we stayed in a Navajo hogan. And when we arrived, we got this on Airbnb, and we arrived in the middle of nowhere, and this beautiful structure inside, it's quite lovely, actually. But our host gave us the rundown. You know, the outhouse is, you know, 100, 150 meters away, and here's where you're staying. And then right at the end, she's like, now, snakes are everywhere around here, rattlesnakes, so, you know, we've set up some helps for you. I'm like, okay. So she said, what we've done is I've put lemongrass and garlic around the hogan, and lemongrass and garlic, there's a path leading to the outhouse of garlic and lemongrass. And apparently, snakes don't like the smell of lemongrass and garlic, apparently, so that will keep them away. So she says, if you need to use the bathroom in the night, follow the path, don't leave the path. Snakes are very active at night, and she kept going on about this snake danger, and finally my brother said, do a lot of people get bitten out here? And she said, oh, no, well, not the locals. And that was disconcerting, because it was like she was looking at it like, you fools definitely might get bit. And I mean, this thing isn't exactly airtight, as you can see there, and of course, I had to pee in the middle of the night. I don't know if this is just me, but more and more, I have to pee in the middle of the night. I don't know what it is. So I wake up that night, and I'm like, oh, no. So I woke up my brother. Can you come pee with me? And he's like, get out of here. I'm like, I got to go. You got to come. And he finally agreed. He even led the way for me, and I was safe following the lemongrass and garlic. But the next day on a hike, we ran into these guys. They had long metal sticks with a little hook around it. And they were going around to rocks and just sticking this in. Finally, you know, they were right with us. I asked them, what are you doing? They're like, oh, we're trying to wrangle out rattlesnakes. Do you want to hang around? No. Do I want to hang around? Are you kidding me? Snakes are dangerous. These guys are trying to catch them. And as soon as I realized what they were doing, I was like, I'm out of here. We've got to create distance between these dangerous people and myself. Snakes are terrifying. I don't want to be close to something that could potentially harm me. And I think that that's exactly what plays out socially for us. We want to create as much distance as we can between ourselves and any potential danger. And so it's a very natural inclination to want to distance ourselves from people who have hurt us or wounded us, maybe represent some kind of danger to us. I mean, have you ever unfollowed or unfriended someone on social media? Right? Yes, right? What is that? There's like a, oh my goodness, this person's posts are not doing well for my mental health. I have to create distance. It's an awkward thing. I had to unfollow my dad. He's not here, is he? That would be awkward. he posts the weirdest stuff. I was like, it's not cool to unfollow your dad, but I had to do it. Dad, I can't follow you on social media anymore. Or social situations, right? There are times when people who have hurt us or have wounded us in some way, and we find ourselves intentionally creating space. These are natural human responses, but what can happen is the enemy-making machine can be at work. It can feed off of these natural instincts. And so what the enemy-making machine can do is turn a legitimate desire for space into vilification and dehumanization. When we distance ourselves from others, it becomes so much easier to retreat, right, to those we feel safe with, people who will take our side, agree with us, people who share our point of view, our side of the story. And in that bubble, it becomes easy to vilify. You know, it's funny to think, I was married 15 years ago. I look back through our wedding photos and of the four groomsmen that stood with me on that day, I only really talked to two of them anymore. And one guy, it's just, he moved, we don't talk, there's some distance there. But my friend Julian, he stood with me on my wedding day, and he and I had always disagreed theologically on stuff. And that was fine when we were in close proximity. But what I've noticed is now that there's distance, it becomes easy when I'm chatting with other friends about him to sort of vilify. That guy's crazy. I can't believe he believes that. I can't believe he holds to that idea. And because of the distance between us now, I found it much easier to just vilify, write him off. Whereas when I'm in close proximity, I like to give the benefit of the doubt to people. And our natural inclination, I think, is to do that when we're hurt or wrong, create distance. It makes a ton of sense to me. And in my own hypocrisy is this, is I tend to be a guy who runs from conflict. I hate it. I hate it. I'd rather just sort of disappear and not have to deal with hurts and wounds that come up in life. And so when I come to Jesus and what the Jesus path asks of me in conflict, I find it hard. I mean, one of the things I think that I'm learning is that the Jesus path so often asks us to move against our natural inclinations. And so when Jesus addresses how to handle conflict, I quite simply don't like it. It feels so uncomfortable to me. I cringe thinking about it. And yet, while I don't like it, I'm still find something compelling about it. So I want to explore that together. This is what Jesus says. If another believer sins against you, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you've won them over. But if they'll not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Now, to unpack this, there's both a simplicity and complexity about what Jesus is saying here. I think the simplicity of what he's saying is, hey, how about this? When somebody does something wrong or hurts you, how about you go talk to them? Simple enough. But simple enough as it sounds, in practice it feels anything but simple. My tendency, again, is to run from conflict, create space, distance. I don't want to go there. The second thing that bothers me, though, is this, is I've tried this, and it hasn't gone well. You ever went to talk to someone and be like, you know, we got a thing, and it doesn't go well? I remember a good friend of mine, very close, and I had observed his dating practices. And I was concerned that there was a little bit of misogyny, a little bit of dating simply to have sex and like it being a conquest thing. And I remember it confronting him about that and immediately being like, that guy should have rethought my strategy, because he got very defensive. And that's what happens when we confront conflict. There's an air in the room, and sometimes we walk into something not knowing how it's going to go, and it creates these defensive postures. But this is difficult stuff to work through. Moreover, there's some real weird misconceptions about this passage. I mean, first, what does it mean when Jesus is like, okay, go through this process, and at the end, just treat them as pagans and tax collectors? These words of Jesus, they've been used to support practices of exclusion, excommunication. I've seen people shunned because of this. Don't talk to them. Don't contact them. We went through the process. They won't listen. They're dead to us. And that bothers me because, to me, it makes no sense contextually. This passage is found directly between two stories Jesus tells about forgiveness. Parable of the lost sheep, which the last song alluded to, going out and finding that one who has gone away. And then a story around forgiveness, which we're going to look at in a second. But for me, I don't see this as an exclusionary thing. In fact, I see it as an inclusive thing. Instead of the pagan and tax collector leaving us off the hook, if we approach someone, it doesn't go well, and then they're sort of dead to us, when we look at Jesus' practices with pagans and tax collectors, well, we see hospitality. Matthew 9, while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Hearing this, Jesus said, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." And suddenly, when I realize how Jesus treats these people, this already uncomfortable passage gets even more uncomfortable, because it sounds to me like what Jesus is sort of suggesting is, go to them. If that doesn't work, bring some other people in. If that doesn't work, bring more people in. If that doesn't work, treat them as tax collectors and pagans, which is essentially, hey, why don't you come for dinner? Why don't we have dinner together? And so some people have made this passage from Jesus a mandate for excluding, but I don't see that. I actually see a mandate for continued inclusion and embracing. And so at first glance, we can look at this and say, okay, there's a process here. Try that. If it doesn't work, oh well, shrug your shoulders. But when we unpack particularly what happens next after this saying, it's clear that this passage is asking a lot of people who traveled the Jesus path. Because directly after this in Matthew 18 says, then Peter came to him and asked, "Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me? 7 times? No, not 7 times, Jesus replied, but 70 times 7. This seems sort of random, right? 70 times 7, I get it a lot. But these numbers here are significant, so give me a moment here to give you a brief ancient history of the significance of 7 to the Hebrew people. 7, Sabbath, 1 in every 7 days, you do no work, you rest. This is very important. Then Sabbath year, 1 year out of 7, everybody rests, everybody's on light duties, including the land. The land is to lay fallow. And then there's Jubilee, 7 times 7. So every 50th year, everybody's forgiven their debts. Everything's restored. All is forgiven. So there's a certain math algorithm within the Hebrew system that allows for forgiveness. But what is also at work, and what the Hebrew people knew, is that there's another algorithm at work. It's the math of revenge. We see it in Genesis 4. Lamech said to his wives, "Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. And so when Jesus shows up, he knows there's a system here for forgiveness, but there's also a system of revenge at work. And it's a 77-to-1 ratio. And so Jesus suggests, if we're going to create a world where revenge is trumped, we're going to need a system that exponentially moves beyond the revenge impulse. And so Jesus suggests 70 times 70, and that those numbers would have rung out in Hebrew people's ears, because there was a hint when they were sent off to Babylon. There were rumors, hints, that maybe there's something even bigger than the Jubilee. Sabbath day, Sabbath year, Jubilee, but maybe there's something bigger. The book of Daniel hints at it. Daniel says this, "While I was still in prayer, Gabriel," the next time Gabriel shows up is at Jesus' birth, The man I had seen in the earlier vision came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I've now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, a word went out, which I've come to tell you, for you're highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. 77s are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So, 77s are 490 years. And word has it that in 490 years, there's going to be the jubilee to end all jubilees. No more need to go through the process. Mega jubilee would announce forgiveness for everyone, end humanity's exile into revenge and retribution. And so when Peter asked Jesus, how many times should I forgive? Seven. And Jesus says, no, 70 times seven. What he's saying is the mega jubilee is here. I am the jubilee. Jesus has come in to usher in the age of forgiveness. And what he's saying to Peter and his followers is this: the willingness to unceasingly extend radical forgiveness is the mega jubilee the world has been waiting for. And Jesus has come to usher it in. And it all starts to come into focus. Forgiveness, releasing those in debt, that's what the jubilee was all about. And so Jesus is asking Peter to take part in the story Jesus is telling. Jesus is saying, Peter, you're now the jubilee as well. We always forgive because we are the jubilee. That's what Jesus' people are about, radical forgiveness. But then come back. So exactly how does this play out? I want to make one thing perfectly clear from the get-go, because I've seen this go horribly wrong. I do not think Jesus' instructions here apply to power dynamics or abuse. And so should someone in a position of power, authority, do something abusive, I don't think this process is what Jesus had in mind. There are certain kinds of hurts and violations that move us well outside the realm of what church is supposed to be. Growing up in our church, we had two incidents occur. One, a 14-year-old girl said she was raped by someone in the church. And our church tried to handle this in-house. And it was a nightmare, a complete mess. And then, when other allegations came up that a pedophile was at work in the church, grooming and hurting young boys, the same thing happened. And it was a shit show. And so I want to make it perfectly clear this morning, I am not talking about that. There are times when we have to use the law. There are times when what we're talking about, the kind of abuse we're talking about, we're not even talking about church anymore. We're outside that realm. So I just want to make that clear, because I don't want anyone here leaving thinking, well, if I'm abused, I guess I got to go through this process. That's not what we're talking about. What I am talking about are the very real hurts and wounds that we accumulate simply because we find ourselves in relationships and in community. And people are prone to errors and flaws and thoughtless words and actions. In fact, I've come to think it is impossible to be in relationship with anyone and not accumulate hurts and wounds over time. Simply part of what it means to be in relationship or community. It's going to happen. And in these situations, we have the propensity to avoid conflict, distance ourselves, and even when we do decide to enter into things, it often makes things worse. People get defensive. And so how do we sort of practically work out and decide how to engage Jesus' invitation here? For me, I tend to start with Paul. Colossians 3 says this: therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience. Bear with each other. Forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Bear with each other. What does that mean? Patience. Tolerance. We're all human and we mess up and we say things and do things that hurt. When we're on the receiving end of that, it's easy to sort of lash out or distance. But I think Paul's saying, we got to be patient. Or in 1 Corinthians 6, this has always stood out to me. It's become a bit of a question whenever ever I've been hurt. But Paul's talking about lawsuits. And again, he's not talking about lawsuits the way we think about it. There was a whole public spectacle display with lawsuits in the ancient world, much like a Twitter mob sort of thing. And so Paul's talking to the Corinthians, says, the very fact that you have lawsuits among you means you've been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? I struggle with that. And every time I've been hurt, that question keeps coming back to me. Some wounds, some hurts are simply not worth the mental energy required to hold on to them. I think, at risk of pushing too far, but I think there's a wisdom and maturity about at times being able to be the bigger person. You know what? I was wrong. It hurt. But I'd rather just hold that and take that and eat that than invite further conflict. I'd rather just live being wronged than jeopardize a relationship. I suppose that might seem like a bit of a cop-out, but I think it makes sense when you think about different types of relationships. How many times, for those of you who are married, are you in your relationship and go, you know what, I'm gonna let that one go. I'm not sure it's worth making a big deal out of this hurt. And I know that plays out for Kristen and I a lot. This might sound like I'm airing my grievances here, but I'm just explaining. But when she puts her shoes on the kitchen table, which I find grotesque and disgusting, I let that go. I just think, why, Brad, why not rather be wronged? And I just eat it. It'd be better if she wasn't here, then I'd see him. Or travel. Have you ever traveled with friends? Oh my goodness, I don't like traveling with friends. Everybody's got annoying quirks. I had made, when I was traveling with my friend Riley, I'm an itinerary guy. We're here at noon, we're in the car by one, and I had this itinerary, and he's just like, whoa, let's pull over here. I'm like, we're way behind. We're 3 hours behind where we need to get to. And in those moments, you got to ask yourself, maybe I should just rather be wronged here. And those are sort of petty examples, but in life, I think there are times you say, you know what? All right, I'll be wronged. I'll just live with that. I often see prayer as a punching bag. Imprecatory Psalms encourage us. That's the place to go and vent. And I started to see prayers that I think God wants us to be so honest in prayer. And so I think for me, prayers become a lot of times a place to work out those petty things. This is annoying me. I don't like this person. They hurt me. Sometimes you can work it through there and just sort of, you know what? It's okay. I'm just going to take this one. But the question, of course, is what happens if you can't let something go? It hurts too much. It's killing you. It's eating up your headspace. You want to create distance, and our propensity, of course, is to retreat, create distance and space, move away. And in that case, I think the process Jesus is laying out here is designed to counter that. Instead of becoming distant, Jesus suggests move closer. One-on-one. And that's hard. But what I think Jesus has in mind here is a one-on-one interaction keeps us from the enemy-making machine propensity to distance. Because our gut says, move away, don't talk to them, create space, retreat. And Jesus says, no, go to them one-on-one. At the very least, you get to express what's been rattling around your head for weeks or months. Keeps us as well, I would say, from gossip. When we start with bringing others in, when we start with trying to surround ourselves by people who agree with us, what can happen is we end up creating an us versus them. So I got me and my friends versus this people. And so Jesus' advice is just go to them, speak to them. Then one or two others, right? If that doesn't work, you know, so often we're reluctant to allow others into the process. But what Jesus has in mind here is we allow others in the process not to vent and get people to take our side. We invite others in with the express purpose of helping us move towards forgiveness and reconciliation. And that's tough. Because when we're hurt, what we want most is a group of people around us who will say, "You're in the right. That was bad. Keep your distance." People who will surround you, put you in a bit of a bubble. Jesus says, no. The point is so that you would go and there can be a process of forgiveness and reconciliation. If that doesn't work, okay, make this circle a bit bigger. And if that doesn't work, I've tried, it hasn't worked. So we treat them like pagans and tax collectors, which to me is this: I will still meet you at the table. I'll still eat with you. I'm committed to being at the table with them, even if it hurts. I don't want to do that. This is so tough. It's tough stuff. Feels to me like, I don't know if you've ever been hiking on a perilous path, and you get to a number of times I've been hiking and got to a part where I'm like, I don't know if I should keep walking there. That looks dangerous. It feels to me like that. This part is dangerous. Yet Jesus is coaxing us on. Travel. Walk with me. I don't want to do it, though. So I'm just going to own my hypocrisy this morning. Here's what I think Jesus is saying. I haven't decided yet whether I'll do it. But that's the invitation. And so in moments where we've been hurt or wounded, in moments where we've been sinned against or wronged, there are several paths we can travel. One, there's the path of avoidance, distancing, which only feeds the enemy-making machine, because now we've got an us versus them. Separating ourselves from pain, retreating. What it really does, though, is it allows bitterness and resentment to build and build inside of us until we are slaves to that. There's the path of Lamech, the path of vengeance, which seeks to merit out retribution on those who have hurt us. And it might not be like Lamech killing someone, but, oh, we're going to make somebody know. Subtle ways, I'll let you know. I'll give you the stink eye. However it plays out, we can travel the path of Lamech, path of vengeance. And then there's the path of Jesus, the path of Jubilee, radical forgiveness, reconciliation. I think it starts by asking ourselves when we're wrong, is this something that I can just deal with on my own? Do I really need to make an issue of this? Can I just eat this? Can I simply accept that I was wronged and move on? If not, what do I need to do to keep myself from being mired in resentment and bitterness? One-on-one. Friends to maybe help. Community maybe help. But even if all that else fails, I'll meet you at the table. I'll still eat with you. Working to extend forgiveness and to work for reconciliation is not the act of excusing poor behavior or actions. It's the liberating work of freeing ourselves from internal resentment and bitterness. It's about not allowing wounds in life to dictate the temperature of our inner worlds, freeing ourselves from the tyrants of distancing and revenge. But to work for that requires walking a very dangerous path. Personally, it's a place I would rather not go, a place I don't want to walk, but whenever I'm nervous about where I sense the Christian path asking me to go, I'm reminded of one of my favorite stories where Peter, after he's reinstated, and Jesus sort of gives him a peek into his own life. He says, when you're young, you dressed yourself and you went where you want. But now, a belt has been tied around your waist and will take you where you would rather not go. And to me, that's the picture I see of the church. We put the belt of the Christian path around our waist, and sometimes it asks us to go where we'd rather not go. This might be one of them. So, this morning, I just want to close with I know there's hurts and wounds out there because it happens to all of us. And again, for the more serious ones, I'm not suggesting this process. Some things need to be dealt with outside of this. But if we're talking about wounds and hurts, what do we need to do with that? Can we work through it on our own? If not, if it's rattling around up there, maybe it's time to take a next step. One-on-one, maybe bringing others in. Not sure. Wisdom and discernment on all our parts. But that, I believe, is the final chapter in my mind on the moving beyond enemies. So I hope we can take what we've explored together in the series and wrestle with them and internalize them. But I would just want to close now with a prayer for strength for us, because it's not easy to put this stuff into practice. So let me close with that. God, you have called us to a path that seems perilous at times, and yet I believe it represents freedom. But it's not easy. And I know this morning there are wounds and hurts in this room that have not been healed, perhaps not dealt with or addressed. I pray that by your Spirit and by the strength of community, you would allow us to walk towards the next steps you're calling us to. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Go in peace.